Hello and welcome to Why Is This Happening with me, your host, Chris Hayes. Well, it's a big day. It's a big day here with Bob. I say that every time, but today's the biggest because you're going to meet someone that I get to hang out with and talk to and work with every day, who is often name-checked on the show. She is she sort of moonlights as a producer on Why Is This Happening, but she's a line producer on All In with Chris Hayes. She's also the offensive coordinator for Chicago Bears. and her name is Tiffany Champion. Tiffany, say hi to the WithPod listeners.
Hello, WithPod fam.
Oh, nice. Tiffany's been the one who has been managing a lot of things about the show, and she's been reading all your emails and forwarding me the good ones, which is like one in 100. And like, that's a joke. And she's been just doing a ton of work. Again, this whole thing, Matt Toter is here too, who has been doing editing with us and is someone who helps produce the show. This is literally like a science project.
it's just like a fun hobby we love to do.
It's like an extra credit class or something. Like when you do Model UN, it's like when you do Model UN in high school, and it's like the people that sign up to do a club where you have to write an extra paper for no reason. Like that's what WithPod is. So it's exciting to have Tiffany here on the microphone. And so today we are doing a year-end, first annual, very special WithPod mailbag. We've been getting tons of really interesting feedback from you and questions and responses to the conversations. And really just, I got to say, just so much gratifying feedback about how much people have not just enjoyed the show, but learned new things from the show, mm-hmm. opened up new avenues of inquiry for themselves. Like it's pushed people to get books or to think about a period in history they haven't thought about, or zoom in on something like mm-hmm. Yemen, a conflict that was in the news sort of simmering in the background. So that's really why we do it. We find that really gratifying because we know firsthand, Tiffany and I particularly, because we work on a daily cable news show. It's called All In with Chris Hayes on at 8 p.m. weeknights. Like just how insane and ceaseless the news cycle could be and how much it can kind of like batter away the ability to go deeper on things and sort of learn context. So mm-hmm. I've been really excited about that. Tiffany, will you tell us like where are you from?
So I am originally from Rockford, Illinois, which is why I'm a diehard Bears fan, thanks to my dad. I came about the show being on All In because I was an NBC page. I don't know if you remember this. I was the second ever page on the show.
I do remember it.
Mm-hmm. So I was one of those people that walked around the building wearing a uniform, giving tours,
like
doing all of the groundwork.
Like 30 Rock.
Yes, that is a common cultural touch point.
So it's like the most. It must be the most common cultural.
Yeah, I think it's probably the only one. And
it's a funny thing when you have a page because when a new page comes and gets rotated through, we have them for like 8 weeks. Is it 8 weeks?
Yeah, it's like a 3 month. They've changed it since I was there, but yeah,
it's like 12 weeks or something. Mm-hmm. So they rotate through, and like when they're there, they're in like street clothes, like they were dressed mm-hmm. like everyone else. But then occasionally you will like see the page who's rotated you, who's in their page outfit. Yes, exactly.
We hate it.
Exactly. Because they have to do like, they have to do a weekend shift doing SNL or whatever. And you'll mm-hmm. see them, and there's like this moment where they like lock eyes with you and then like turn away in like terrible embarrassment because you've seen them in their page outfit when like in the office they're a normal person. Now it's like, no, don't look at me.
Yeah, it's exactly that. I'm, you know, Midwesterner at heart. I was planning to move back to Chicago and was offered an opportunity on the show. And I've been with y'all ever since. And then have been so lucky to start this podcast, this little side project, and read all of your emails. I read them. If you have gotten a response, my fingers have typed those words. If it is at 2 o'clock in the morning, it's because I couldn't sleep and I wanted to keep reading. If it was at 8 o'clock in the morning, I was drinking coffee with my dog in my lap. Like I am reading these all the time because
if it's at 8:15, it's because she's not doing her job. Yeah. While
I'm
producing.
I'm in the control
all of
room.
Chris Hayes, and she's in the control room, just taking a little break from timing how long the A block is.
Yeah, and it is. It's amazing the things that people say that they never thought they would connect to. People that said, "Oh, I didn't think I would care about the census, but this is the most important thing to me now." Or where you guys listen to them. You listen
totally.
To them while you were cooking Thanksgiving dinner, and people who are driving trucks long range, they are listening to them then. Like,
shout
so
out
cool.
to people driving truck yeah. and listening to WithPod. That's awesome. That makes me so happy that I've interviewed truck drivers through my life in various journalistic capacities and known people who've done it. And I know like it's like having stuff to listen to is such a key part of making that job an experience that passes more quickly than it could.
Yeah, whenever Chris says it genuinely, we love hearing from you, the things that you take away from it, and the questions that you have, which is why sometimes I do my best to answer them. I will send links and references and things like that. But if there are some longer form things that I think you might want to hear Chris's answer to, I would suggest us doing an entire episode about that, which is what we're doing today. So without further ado, I have a couple of questions.
Let's hit the mailbag.
Yeah.
Tiffany right now, just because this is it's not a visual medium, she's holding a literal Santa's bag, like in the iconic scene, A Miracle on 34th Street. And there's just like paper sort of sticking out of it in sort of wayward fashion. So she's now reaching in to pull out the first.
So something that a lot of people really connected to, similar to the census one, was on Yemen. A lot of people wrote in about Yemen and had questions about that. This one is from Christina, who says she's listened to the podcast twice with Shireen, which is something a lot of people do, is listen to it multiple times. And she says, it seems to say that Iran and Saudi Arabia have both placed themselves in the conflict and that the people of Yemen are not in coordination with either. However, Congress keeps saying on TV that Yemenis are working with Iran and getting their weapons from them. So which one is it?
It's a great question. I think the answer to that is really complicated. So one of the things I think Shireen tried to sort of make clear in that conversation is there's two things going on. There are fault lines in Yemeni society that are sort of domestic fault lines in Yemeni society that have to do with different regions of the country physically, different sectarian lines of access, different political lines, right? So there are divisions within Yemeni society. There was a civil war that was fought formerly, and the Houthi rebels, who are one of the sort of sides in this conflict, predate this particular conflict. They've been around for a while. Those have then been kind of jacked up, engineered, and used by foreign proxy actors. So the Saudis have kind of, you know, put themselves in the middle of the putative Yemeni government, while the Iranians have been backing the Houthi rebels. I mean, one way to think about it, right, is like when the U.S. fought its Revolutionary War, a huge part of what made the Revolutionary War work, in some ways you could say like a kind of counterfactually, but for this, we may not have won, was French assistance. You know, we went to the French and said, like, help us out. And France kind of tried to figure out one way or the other about whether they wanted to get involved in this conflict or not. They ended up getting involved. Similarly, during the Civil War, it was a huge question about whether foreign governments would recognize the Confederacy, and it would have made an enormous difference if, say, Britain had recognized the Confederacy. So in both those cases, right, there's domestic lines of dispute. Like, it's not the case that, like, it's just a proxy war for France, the American Revolution. It's actually there's domestic issues being fought. Same thing in the Civil War. But it also matters enormously what foreign nations are doing. And I think that's kind of the way to think about what's happening in Yemen, that there are genuine domestic lines of dispute, that the putative government genuinely is a Saudi entity insofar as the president Hadi of the country lives in Saudi Arabia. Like, doesn't live in Yemen because the capital is controlled by the rebels. And also the Houthis are getting support from the Iranians. That support, by the way, has increased as the war has stretched on. There's many people who argue that one way to stop further Iranian encroachment in the conflict is to end the conflict itself and to stop the bombardment, because the longer it goes on, the more the Iranians see themselves as having a stake in it and the more enmeshed they get precisely in the battle.
So when she watches her representatives or other representatives on TV, they're sort of picking and choosing which side is what you're saying, which side is best going to fit with their.
Yeah, here's one way to think about it. The line from supporters of the war and supporters of the U.S.-Saudi alliance has been that essentially this is on Saudi's backstep and the Yemenis don't have a say, really. The Yemenis have a legitimate government that's been overrun by this Iranian menace, and that the Houthis are essentially a stalking horse for Iran's territorial ambitions to spread out throughout the region. And they went into Syria, where they've been fighting alongside the Assad forces and the Russians to put down the rebellion there and the revolution. They're now in the Arabian Peninsula. They have a foothold on the Arabian Peninsula. And the Iranian-Persian menace has to be rolled back. It's not crazily different than the kind of domino theory that was in operation for much of the Cold War, right? Like, why are we fighting the Vietnamese? Well, because actually they're a projection of Chinese or Soviet power. They're a projection of communist power. And the idea, I think, that the sort of tragic mistake, again, of the Vietnam War, right, was refusing to see the actual domestic political considerations as being primary to the Vietnamese, and instead viewing the entire conflict entirely through a framework of countries that were not Vietnam. right? So the reason that we go and fight in Vietnam for so long, the reason that we have the Vietnamese War, is that UN foreign policy really refuses to wrestle with and acknowledge their genuine political divisions within Vietnamese society and among the Vietnamese people that are the drivers of the conflict, as opposed to it solely being a projection of global communism. And I think there's an analogy here in the mistake that supporters of the war are making here. And I think that's a thing that Shireen really kind of tries to hit home on. Like, these forces predate whatever the Iranians were or were not doing. And a lot of American politicians and sort of foreign policy sites are so wedded to the sort of Saudi alliance that they kind of refuse to see that.
If you will allow me, this isn't a question. This is just something that someone had written in about this.
Yeah.
That I thought was so just a really lovely thing to say. She said, I sometimes feel so hopeless when it comes to topics like this because I live in a blue state and my representatives most always vote the way that I like. She's writing specifically about learning about Yemen. But when you ask people to call the representatives about the current War Resolutions Act, and I didn't see my congresswoman as a sponsor, I decided to call. You inspired me to call, even though I figured she would vote as I hoped, and the experience felt good. And I think that's amazing. Even if you live in a state where you think that the person that represents you is going to vote the way that you are, still make your voice heard. That
totally.
Is important.
And not only that, that is great, and we should note that, you know, just within the last few weeks, the Senate, before it recessed, for the first time since the 1970s, did pass a War Powers Resolution saying the U.S. should stop military aid. It got killed in the House in a really shady way, buried in the rule on the farm vote. Thank you, Paul Ryan. But it's going to come up again in the new Democratic Congress. So this is not over. And if you feel strongly about this, as I obviously think you should, like, you should keep putting the pressure on. And the last thing I'll say about that great email is, a huge part of the way power works in Washington, I know from covering the Capitol as a reporter, is it's not just like what position a politician has, it's what they prioritize and what they throw their back into and what they care about. And so it's like it may be the case that in some vague sense, your congressperson is going to vote the right way on the Yemen bill. But like, do they care about it and do they think their constituents care about it and are they going to prioritize it? And that's why I think like really calling members of Congress, contacting them really works for that.
Totally. This one is from John. It's about the social infrastructure conversation we had with Eric Kleinenberg. He said, I found it fascinating. I get the idea, especially with regards to libraries, parks, and subways, but the discussion was very urban-centric. It struck me, as I live in a small rural city, what sort of social infrastructure can be put in place for rural areas? Libraries are universal, but subways and large parks are not relevant necessarily in the country. So how can you build social infrastructure for rural America?
That is a fantastic question. And honestly, one I don't have a great sense of. I mean, obviously, my personal life experience is extremely urban centric. I grew up in the Bronx in New York City. I've lived in New York, Chicago, and Washington are the places I lived for any extended period of time. So I've only lived in urban areas. When I've been in rural areas, and I have some experience in rural area because we have a place upstate that we go to. There are some obvious pieces of social infrastructure. So libraries are a big one, right? Libraries are in urban America and they're in rural America, and they're super important in both places. There are things like county fair sites and county fairs and the Farm Bureau in rural America. There used to be more sites, I think, of sort of collective meeting in rural America that have been sort of deconstructed over time. And I think actually it's really important to have those things. I mean, the county fairgrounds end up being in a rural county, like a massively important piece of social infrastructure. And the county fair is a massively important piece of social infrastructure in places where the state fair, like those are more than just like kitschy corn dogs. They're actually places where you sort of weave together the fabric of society. Mm-hmm. When you go back and you read about the populist movement, you know, in rural America, particularly in the late 19th century, there's all sorts of ways in which people are coming together and sort of, you know, under tents or at granaries or places like that to sort of create the conditions for political and social movements. And I think it's a great question to think about. Like, other than libraries and I would say like fairgrounds, right? Mm-hmm. What are the kinds of things that constitute social infrastructure in rural America or small town America, and how can that be built out?
The question from John in social infrastructure sort of leads to this one from Joel. I want to ask two from him. But one, you talked a lot in the social infrastructure conversation about the subways and how they are this very unique sort of ecosystem that are taken for granted, I think, but very common in larger cities. And you talked about being so close to all these different types of people. And Joel wants to know, what's the last surprising experience that you had while on the subway?
The most surprising experience that I've had on the subway.
or weird or the things that make you smile or any of this?
You know what? To be honest, there's sort of too many to recount. Like, I'm doing that thing where someone's like, what books do you like? And your mind blank is like, I've never read a book. There's a lot of things I love about Subway. One is, like, I love when, like, a bunch of young kids come on to perform and you think that you start to like stereotype certain kinds of people as they're going to be the kinds of people who turn up their nose and don't like this and other people are going to like it. And then it's totally scrambled. Mm-hmm. Like the way that you are constantly assessing people on the subway in sort of like, you know, their externality and their typography and what stop they got on. And you're kind of like seeing this mix of people. And then moments that happen on the subway, like the subway stops or like people have to talk to each other because like there's some issue or like a performer comes on. And that the kind of the sort of community gets like very briefly but intensely instantiated.
Totally.
And like people, and I've seen people a lot of times on the subway, like someone being a jerk to someone else and someone sticking up for the person who's a victim. And a lot of times what's really amazing about that is the way that that cuts across like race and class lines. Like people will stick up for, not always. I mean, sometimes it cuts right with race and class lines in a really unnerving, upsetting way. But sometimes it doesn't. And a lot of times I've seen, you know, people stick up for other people who don't at all look like them or are from the same background as them. But like there's this moment of connection and solidarity in the face of someone acting like a jerk that I've seen time and time again, like too many times to really sort of recite and count, that just makes you feel like this real intense sense of connection and solidarity and pride. Do you feel that way?
Oh, yeah. I talk about this all the time, how the train car that you're on suddenly is this own little world and each of these people bring their own things to it. I recently had a woman who experienced a medical emergency. She had passed out while on the train. And she was by herself, and all of a sudden, all of these people were attending to her. They got her back up on the seat. They were making sure all of the contents that had spilled out of her purse were there, flagging the conductor to make sure that they knew, getting an emergency response. Like, all of a sudden, none of these people knew each other, but they were all there for her because that is what you do.
And the thing about the subway that, like, the thing I find so infuriating about what has happened to the subway is that, like, it really is this universal thing. It really is this public trust in the city where it's like, everyone from homeless people to bankers use a subway. Like, and the reason is it's a public good that can't be replicated. Like, you can get in an Uber and sit in traffic for 30 minutes, but like the fastest way to get from Broadway Lafayette to Rockefeller Center is train. Like, that's just like, it doesn't matter if you're the richest person in the freaking universe, that's still the fastest way to go.
I saw a guy in tails with a dozen white roses. Like, he was going to some like amazing event in which you would wear tails and have a dozen white roses. And I said to him, I was like, you look fantastic. He's like, oh, thank you. I'm going to a show. I was like, well, of course you are. But
on the subway.
On the subway as
and
I'm schlepping.
And that's the thing that makes me so upset is that like the worse that it gets and the more underinvested it gets and the worse the times get, like the more that you're seeing these fracturing where it's like, well, I will take an Uber, I will take this because the subway is for like is the slow mode, and like, no, like we have to really hold on to the subway being the best mode.
So the other question that Joel had is, following your conversation with Tim Wu, which was one of our earlier ones about who broke the internet, he wants to know, Joel wants to know, information that's been disclosed since we had that, there's been a lot of news about Facebook and Twitter, how do you see the chances of meaningful internet technology developing, social media regulation, antitrust reform, that sort of thing?
I think there's going to be, I mean, Tim Wu has actually got a new book out called, I think, The Curse of Bigness, which is kind of about monopoly and concentration, which is something that we have a forthcoming, we've got a forthcoming conversation actually coming out about with respect to Amazon specifically. I think there's big movement afoot. I mean, I think what the kind of power that Facebook has every day bringing some new insane story about how it's violating people's privacy, fundamentally how it's doing things that you don't know about. That's really that's the rub here, right? Like there's this way in which you react to consumer products you use where it's like there's what you know and what you don't know. And that's true, I think, of everyone. Like when you buy a piece of clothing, you know, that was what the sort of sweatshop movement was about. Like, where was it made and under what conditions? And the fact that that's hidden away from you is, it can be really messed up. But this is even more intimate because it's about your actual data.
Right.
It's about, like, the stuff about you that this company has control over. And also just the insane power they have. And I think that just untenable. I mean, this idea that, you know, the stories about the way that Facebook drove, say, hate crimes against refugees in Germany which is a study that came out since we talked to Tim Wu, or like a key driver of genocide against Rohingya in Myanmar, like the idea that the Facebook's like, sorry, trying to fix it about everything, when like, sorry, trying to fix it is trying to fix our platform as a tool for genocide and Rohingya. It's like, well, what? You've got some room in Palo Alto where they're going to figure out the ways to like not exacerbate the worst aspects of the Myanmar regime? Like, it doesn't calculate. It doesn't scan. Like, they're too big and too powerful, and they can't wield the power responsibly. I think that's a conclusion people are increasingly going toward. And so there is going to be only a growing movement to rein them in lots of ways, rein them in or break them up. And it's going to be one of the most interesting stories of political economy, I think, over the next few years.
How do you feel with all of these headlines that we've been covering specifically about Facebook, but just as you, as a user of these platforms, how do you feel?
Yeah, I feel tortured about it. I mean, I've been thinking about it. I've been watching a lot of people get off Facebook and thinking about doing the same. Mm-hmm. But I use Instagram a lot and I really like it. And then it feels a little like, you know, like you give up pork, but you keep eating beef. And it's like, what have you really done? Like, Facebook and social media is increasingly ending up in the category of like watching football, eating meat, of like things I cannot defend.
Yeah.
Like, I literally can't defend them in an intellectual level, but do them. But really, like, I think of those in the same three categories. Like, eating meat, I think, is basically philosophically and intellectually indefensible, and yet I do it.
Mm-hmm.
I really, just because, like, I'm lazy and also like it, but it's like, it's a moral failing. Watching football, I think, is basically indefensible. Like, the sport of it is indefensible, but, like, I like watching football. Now, this year, I've sort of given it up. And I think, like, using Facebook is essentially indefensible. And it's different in a different way because, like, in those two cases, you're directly contributing, I think, in a way where Facebook, it's like, it's not a sort of personal moral failing to use Facebook because they're really the predator there. Like, in the case of football and meat, I think it's a little different morally or feels like a little more cutting. But it's all now kind of in that same category for me. I'm just filled with a lot of Catholic guilt. I don't know. Like, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I think I'm going to, I don't know. What do you, are you going to stay on Facebook?
Probably only because, not that I post anything, but being so far away from my family and especially shockingly less of my own friends, but my older generations of families, great aunts, great uncles that are on it. That is how I keep up with them. They aren't the type of people that are going to pick up and call me. But that's where I find out about them and they post pictures. And so that's how I keep in contact with them.
I will say that, like, I also think that it's funny, I was going to say, like, the group chat on WhatsApp, which is owned by freaking Facebook. I was going to be like, get off Facebook and get on WhatsApp, owned by Facebook. But I do think that one thing that I have found, like, the one part of the internet and social media, or it's not social media, that I actually love the most is the group chat, which to me has kind of replaced a little bit of what social media used to be able to do. So, like, I'm in a group chat with my high school friends. I'm in a group chat with my wife and some of our friends from, like, the time we lived in D.C., and, like, that's a great place to get, like, Halloween costume pictures of the people's kids and, like, updates and stuff and, like, you know, shoot the shit, talk trash with my, you know, my high school buddies.
Mm-hmm.
That fills that need of, like, I'm connected to these people, but it's private. You know, it's not, like, and there's no data being exchanged and no one's trying to sell me an ad. And I actually think, like, that's filling a hole that social media used to have for me.
Yeah, totally. So probably our last question is a common question also, which is, where does Chris find the time to keep up reading with all of the books that we cover? Does he set aside dedicated time to this during the day or the week? Does he just catch them when he can? Or does his assistant read the book of his guests and provide him with a synopsis of which he can frame his questions?
Do you want to answer that, the last part about the assistant?
Yeah, no. So Chris's assistant, Aileen, is the best person, I think.
Big fan.
She's amazing. She covers
everything.
She is two steps ahead of you in whatever you need to do.
Yes.
She does not read those books.
She does not read
those books. No. She has her own time and job.
Yes. So one of the things I like about this job is that it's forced me to read more books. And honestly, I'm a big believer in the Kindle app on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer to read books on paper, but when I have to read a book and I have the deadline, I know I have to read it, my phone is always there. And what it does is, if I'm online waiting for coffee rather than scrolling through Twitter, I have 5 more minutes to read the book.
Mm-hmm.
I can read on the way home. I can read on the way in the subway. I can read it before I go to bed. And like, it's not the greatest thing in the world to be looking at the screen, but it's always there. And that just makes it way easier to get through a book. I also read really fast, like real fast.
And I'm jealous of that.
It's been a huge comparative advantage for my most of my both childhood and adult life. So, but yeah, that's basically what we do. If there's a book,
Chris reads it.
I read
it. It's all Chris. I lied. I have one last question, and this is from me. There are a lot of moments when we're recording these conversations, and the guest says something that is just so shocking. We look at each other and are like, oh my gosh, eyes wide, mouth agape. That's amazing. What do you think is the biggest moment that we've had this year that comes to mind of that holy crap moment?
I will tell you, the biggest holy crap moment, I think, is Nick Ackerman on why Nixon put the tapes in the White House, basically. And this was never, I went back after this. It was such a holy crap moment that I like fact checked it. Mm-hmm. And it was never kind of like, basically it was never definitively established, but it was definitely the belief of the prosecutors, which was this, that it used to be the case that giving your papers to like the National Archive could be written off as a donation for tax purposes by an exiting president. They closed that loophole while Nixon was in office, or as he was entering office, I think, and he was pissed. But that was only written items, not recordings. Mm-hmm. It would still be the case that if you donated recordings, you could write that off as a donation for tax purposes. And so he installed the taping system to produce recordings that he could then donate to get a tax write-off. Which ended up being his downfall.
Wild.
The greediness of trying to get the tax write-off ended up being his downfall. That moment is my number one, like, holy shit moment.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, Tiffany Champion, thank you so much for all your work.
Thank you.
And for doing the mailbag. There are obviously a bunch more questions. I think we'll keep doing, we'll do occasional mailbags, I think.
Yeah.
And we'll do occasional, you know, we haven't sort of formalized it, but we'll do responses to stuff as we go along. So keep writing to us. And you've now heard the voice of the person who's on the other line when you write. You can tweet us, hashtag withpod, email us, withpod@gmail.com. That's the email address that is all read by Tiffany Champion. Why Is This Happening is presented by MSNBC and NBC News, produced by the All In team, and features music by Eddie Cooper. You can see more of our work, including links to things we mentioned here, by going to nbcnews.com/whyisthishappening.